listening to the Nerds Assemble podcast.
Welcome to episode 137 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
I'm Paul, aka Cookie.
We have no Retroid.
And I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
This week, it's his birthday, and somebody's like, come on, let's go out drinking. And so he's out drinking. And, you know, and painting the town red, one assumes, and all that kind of crazy, crazy jazz.
Green was more his colour.
It might be green as well. Maybe he'll paint the town green and red. Who knows? You know. This week we will be talking about Simon Pegg, inevitably Supernatural, Castle, and more other cool shizzle. As ever, you can find notes for this episode over on www.nerdsassemble.co.uk. You could also tweet us right now at Nerds Podcast. If you feel like emailing us, you know, because you don't use Twitter or something, you can do so at contact@nerdsassemble.co.uk. And this episode is also available on iTunes and Stitcher. So, we said Simon Pegg. There was this huge uproar on the internet last week after quotes from a Radio Times interview surfaced on sites such as IO9. Simon Pegg had apparently claimed that our love of sci-fi was essentially making us, and by us, I don't know, anyone who wasn't a child, or isn't a child anymore, childish. It was a weird mass generalisation on Pegg's part, which he then had to later recant on his own personal blog. And maybe I should just read the quote that kind of got him in hot water. So from Radio Times, to quote, "Before Star Wars, the films that were box office hits were The Godfather, Taxi Driver, Bonnie and Clyde and The French Connection, gritty, amoral art movies. Then suddenly the onus switched over to spectacle and everything changed. I don't know if that is a good thing. Obviously, I'm very much a self-confessed fan of science fiction and genre cinema, but part of me looks at society as it is now and just thinks that we've been infantilised by our own taste. Now we're essentially all consuming very childish things, comic books, superheroes. Adults are watching this stuff and taking it seriously. It's kind of dumbing down in a way because it's taken our focus away from real-world issues. Films used to be about challenging emotional journeys or moral questions that might make you walk away and reevaluate how you felt about whatever. Now we're walking out of the cinema really not thinking about anything other than the fact that the Hulk just had a fight with a robot." So that was his original statement, which, to be fair, he didn't really manage to improve upon, other than sort of trying to basically academicize what he had already said on his personal blog by digging up such great postmodern theorists as Jean Baudrillard. Because, you know, that's what you do when you try to say that you didn't say that science fiction currently, as it is leading to childish infantilization of fans.
I don't think it is, though. It's always been there. If you look at it throughout history, everybody seems to have an inner child. Before sci-fi, adults like to play with model railways, collect corgi trucks.
I think in certainly Western societies, due to the mechanisation of a lot of things in terms of work and housework and all that kind of thing, obviously we have more leisure time now, and so what are we to fill our leisure time with?
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be,
well, I mean, I think
trips to the cinema.
To the other side of things, a lot of superheroes are necessarily set up so that there's, you know, this dichotomy of the, you know, the good guy, the all, you know, trying to be at the all-powerful evil dude, and
cinema like horror.
Problem is, Pegg's comments took away a huge chunk of the context behind how cinema operates.
cinema is there to offer us escapism.
He put the onus, to me, it seems, on the audience and what they were going to see. And so even though for every Nightcrawler, there's a whole bunch of comic book movies that people will go and see today. And those comic book movies are going to do better than Nightcrawler, because I'm trying to compare him saying something like Taxi Driver and the fact that obviously Star Wars came out within the same sort of period. He's... Like, the films that he sort of picked up on, they weren't hugely popular. There was stuff that was sort of more popular and tailored towards general audiences at the time. I mean, at the period that he's looking at with, like, The French Connection and stuff like that, or even, like, I don't know, Chinatown. Yeah. That was a period where, spaghetti westerns, which had been a popular genre for decades, or westerns, were suddenly kind of, like, disappearing from popularity in certainly American cinemas. There was this crop of auteurs, which is what the films he was kind of talking about, kind of cropped up in America, making films like that from the late 60s to the early 80s. So this, you know, like 15 to 20 year period where gritty shit was being made and studios were paying for it. It wasn't necessarily audiences that were controlling whether things were being made. I mean, Paul, could you explain how the auteur influence kind of enabled those gritty kinds of films to be made for a while? And then I'll talk about how marketing affected everything.
You're dragging me.
I'm dragging you in.
I'm not necessarily disagreeing with Simon Pegg, though. That's the problem.
But can you explain how the auteur thing influenced cinema for a while?
Well, I mean, auteur theory kind of crept over and
from
France, and auteur theory is basically how film directors are pretty much like artists and leaving signatures over their piece of work. So say, for example, recurrent themes or recurrent characters or other marks that prove that this director made this film.
The Hollywood system kind of turned them into artists' word was word.
Well, exactly. So basically they took the director as the artist, and therefore everything that they did was gold. You know, you shower that director with money and they will, shower you with even greater money. And that did not work.
Yeah, it kind of, the myth, well, I say the myth, the delusion persisted for quite a while and led to some really big fuck-ups in Hollywood. So, the sort of films that Peg's referring to in that same sort of period then, I mean, apart from the fact that he kind of ignored Jaws, which was a disaster movie of a sort, and thriller, so sort of two sort of hybrid genres at the time, which came out before Star Wars, because he ended up drawing on Star Wars a lot for the sort of sci-fi recants. And it's like, well, you had Jaws come out, and that was recognised as the first blockbuster. Mm-hmm. And so kind of got studios interested in the model. But to be fair, Jaws had a very terrible filming experience. It was actually quite hard for them to get it off the ground. A lot of problems happened during the production process.
Well, part of the problem was that, the shark itself was kind of unrealistic and destroyed the illusion.
Yeah.
So they ended up trying to edit it together so that, you didn't actually see the shark, which made it,
Nobody expected it to be a hit. The following, what was it, year, 2 years? When did the first Star Wars come out after Jaws? How many years was that?
Star Wars was 78, wasn't it?
The Jaws was the year before then.
77, wasn't it?
Yeah, so Jaws 77, what, Star Wars 78?
No. Star Wars was 77, I thought.
Jaws was before Star Wars.
Hang on.
Jaws was before Star Wars.
By the power of Google, I have the power.
An unexpected success. It really was genuinely unexpected that it was the runaway success that it was. But, I mean, you'd had...
Yeah. So, Star Wars was released on May the 25th, 1977.
But Jaws was...
Happy anniversary... Jaws was June the 1st, 1975.
There we go.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so Jaws was an unexpected runaway success, and nobody made, they didn't make Star Wars expecting to have
well, no,
the same level of runaway success. But the interesting story, and this is a story that we heard, and I think we've talked about this on the podcast last year, when we went to see Sorcerer last year on 35mm at local cinema with Mark Kermode sort of leading up things. And this is a William Friedkin film. So Friedkin made The French Connection. He also made The Exorcist. And after those two films, he made this film called Sorcerer, which has nothing to do with magic. Anyway, this film was in development hell for years. Studio threw millions at it. And then ends up being released on the same weekend as the first Star Wars film.
Ouch.
Yeah. No. Okay, nobody knew that Star Wars was going to be crazy. Sorcerer at this point is like already a black mark against the studio. The studio wasn't pulling its weight, wasn't marketing it with any near the level of ferocity of what Star Wars got. And even Star Wars wasn't like heavily marketed when it first came out. That first installment came out. You know, only sort of spiralled out afterwards when the popularity was realised.
And we're talking about the marketing of 1970s.
Yeah.
You know, nowadays, you have so much more.
So Sorcerer was neglected. And Sorcerer is the kind of film that Pegg is trying to big up in this initial interview. It's a very thoughtful film. It's a remake, essentially. Well, I say remake. It's a reimagining of the story behind the Grapes of Wrath, about a group of despicable men sort of trying to redeem themselves against unimaginable odds, and it's the kind of sort of it's a thriller for all intents and purposes that works really well. And unfortunately, it's really hard to get a copy of the film in this part of the world these days. Anyway, so this film comes out the same week as Star Wars. This epitome of science fiction and dumbing down of science fiction, which Pegg's kind of leaning towards. Because, let's face it, Star Wars is quite the space opera there, and it was kind of filmed like a B-movie. It doesn't have as many complexities as certain science fiction has had prior, either in film, literature, or afterwards in film and literature.
No.
But anyway, so you know, this Sorcerer comes out. Sorcerer freaking bombs. It's a really good film. It genuinely is a good film. The damn thing bombs. It's mismarketed to the hills. But Star Wars, meanwhile, is reasonably marketed, does very well, and word of mouth helps them because it starts doing well, blah, blah, blah. People watch it, it makes money, and another one gets made. Meanwhile, Sorcerer doesn't make the studios really anything and essentially gets mothballed into obscurity afterwards and includes an international release that cut out the first 30 minutes of the film, which actually helped explain why the hell you had this group of men doing this impossible thing in the first place, thus further putting the film into obscurity. And it's only until recent years that the whole thing's been available for viewing.
Yeah.
And to me, this is where I'm kind of going. Like, you can blame where the audience goes as much as you like, but to me, at a certain point, there are studios and distributors making decisions about what they will push the most, what they'll market the most, you know, what they'll throw the most money at to get it in people in front of it. And with the success of, I mean, and then to call Jaws, which was obviously the first blockbuster as we know it, kind of stupid. It's not, because it's actually an intelligently well-made film because of how they handled the issue of the shark looking like crap and essentially doing a lot of suggestive editing techniques so that you're not always constantly looking at the shark in order to have fear.
But did Pegg actually say that?
He managed to forget about Jaws and went straight for Star Wars and the blockbuster syndrome, even though Jaws had set up the precedent several years beforehand. Which kind of annoyed me about his argument, because he was forgetting a whole lot of his cinematic history.
But then you've also got another big franchise that was doing the rounds then, because in 1977 it became the biggest movie franchise at the time, which was James Bond.
Yep.
Missed that one out totally.
And that's the spy subgenre. But then at the same time, the James Bond films, heavily marketed.
Oh, yeah.
And also,
they had a marketing budget to die for themselves, didn't they?
And also had a whole series of novels to back it up. You know, which kind of helps, as recent young adult fic films have found. you know, in terms of reaching popularity.
But the one thing that I think does ring true about one of his quotes, which he says, you know, part of me looks at society as it is now. And you do actually generally tend to find that genre stuff is pushed towards more towards the mainstream than ever before. I mean, horror films, for example, that is no longer just, you know, sort of like, you know, small art house cinemas or, you know, small, you know, kind of groups going to see it and whatnot. It is being pushed more and more into the mainstream.
Yeah, but then that's been kind of been happening since Hammer's time.
Hammer horror, yeah.
Mm.
And that's that's several decades ago. More than several decades ago that they started. But the whole sort of like stuff's being dumbed down, and it's like, well, and people are talking about this, and he's talking about, to me, he's just talking about the audience. It's like, yeah, but the decisions to dumb shit down are happening at the studio level. It's happening before the film gets to the audience.
To be honest, I'm not 100% sure whether he is necessarily talking about the audience.
He doesn't blame the studios.
Well, he's not blaming anybody. He's just, you know,
he's just stating a point that this is what happens in today's society.
Yeah.
But then, I mean, I don't... not just today's society, though. It's been happening...
Well, yeah, because the James Bond films of the
60s.
70s, 60s, 70s... Oh, God, some of them are just absolutely freaking ridiculous. And it's the ones of Roger Moore and are some of the worst. Yeah.
Back off. Back
I mean,
off.
I think to a certain extent, the one thing that Peg does sometimes... has kind of missed out on here is the fact that comic books and superheroes, there can be, you know, more of a dichotomy of... more than a dichotomy of good guy versus bad guy.
Yeah.
You know, say, for example, Kick-Ass, that is, you know, bringing what would happen if superheroes were real into the world.
But they were also just people.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
They didn't have special powers, did they?
No.
Exactly. And,
well, not until he went and became Quicksilver.
To a certain extent, the same thing with Watchmen as well. The fact that, you know, you have, you know, a group of so-called superheroes, only one of them is, you know, superhuman, and they all have completely different moral compasses.
But do you know what, though? Kick-Ass, Watchmen haven't done as well at the box office as less thoughtful comic book films.
Exactly, but I mean, that kind of goes into his point, in a way.
But
you know, the fact that we as a society are consuming more of the kind of almost mindless, you know, not necessarily mindless, but...
going out and seeing
the marketing, I would say, for both Kick-Ass and Watchmen is still never... or still, it didn't reach the levels found with Marvel's films.
I mean, I don't necessarily want to make this connection obvious or anything, but obviously Simon Pegg is, you know, good friends with... Edgar Wright, and Edgar Wright did get, was on Ant-Man for a while, and then
went horribly wrong.
Yes, so it could be, you know, slight, you know, thing about that. I'm not saying that it is, but you know.
But
saying that, there was an interview on the Stars who'd seen the original script, and they were saying it was a good old fashioned sort of romp, good light-hearted and that, and now they're saying that the new script is a bit darker. Got a bit more meaning to it.
But it just... It's
probably because, you know, it's designed to fit into the Marvel-verse, or the Marvel Cinematic Universe, at least.
I do feel the emphasis is being put on the audience, because it's like, adults are watching this stuff and taking it seriously, and it's like the only stuff that's being mainly put out. There is thoughtful sci-fi coming out there, but as I'm saying, it doesn't get marketed as well. Like, Transcendence is... on reflection, I mean, I didn't like it that much when I initially watched it, but having further time to think about it, it's actually really... it's a really clever science fiction film.
I really like...
You're in the same boat as Mark Kermode. Mark Kermode really liked...
I mean, in a way, it's one of those things where, with Transcendence, there is no bad guy. There's basically a guy that uploads his mind to a computer, and the computerized mind ends up being, like, obviously hyper-intelligent, because it's got, you know...
Yeah.
Whatever, and then people turn against it because they fear, you know, that it's no longer the man.
But also, one of the biggest films...
It makes you think, doesn't it? It does put you on a bit more of an emotional journey.
Also, one of the biggest films of last... Yeah, I was going to say, one of the biggest sci-fi films of last year was Interstellar, and that does not dumb stuff down.
No.
That is a very intelligently made film, and, well, if you could get your head around a lot of the stuff that was in it, it did leave you... questioning things after you left the cinema. There is definitely a discrepancy in marketing between what happens with Marvel, what happens with the Fox Marvel films, what happened or happened with Sony's Marvel films. There is a huge marketing discrepancy between how much money those things get thrown at them once they want to get it out to the public versus something like Transcendence. And also, there are loads of really intelligent sort of sci-fi novels out there that have been stuck in development hell for years as films. I was just reading today that they're looking for another director for Neuromancer, which is obviously based off the classic William Gibson novel, which is seen as the founding cornerstone of cyberpunk, which came out in something like 82 or 84. I think probably 84, and it was like, and that's over, that's 31 years that book has essentially kind of since that was published, and a film hasn't happened yet, but it's been it has essentially been stuck in development film, and that is a very intelligent novel, and to translate that to film, like the studio, hopefully wouldn't interfere too much, but at the same time, are they going to throw the money at it? Are they going to have the confidence to throw money at it to market it once it does finally come out?
Can I just ask, because obviously Peg is, you know, very almost focused on stuff like the Avengers and the Marvel films and whatnot here. Yeah. Do any of those really actually say anything, do you think?
I felt that...
They do. They say Hulk smash.
I felt that Iron Man 3 was quite a thoughtful film.
In what respect?
It questioned sort of like the issue of how far should a single man push himself for the greater good, because Tony's already broken, as it were, psychologically at the beginning of the film, and then he sort of pushes himself further on for the sake of a greater good, but he's just one man and he's kind of, you know, he's sort of trying to claw out of this mess that he's created in his head whilst helping people. It's just this kind of personal struggle thing going on. But as to commentary, greater commentary about society, I would say that would go to Captain America the Winter Soldier, because the whole thing that Hydra cooks up in that film is very reminiscent of numerous cyber terrorism laws and lawmaking policies that are currently in government or going through governments. And a lot of it is based on predictive analytics and this concept of big data and predicting trends before they happen and then acting upon them before they can happen. And that is a genuine, which is why I think Captain America the Winter Soldier is probably one of the better films out of the Marvel Universe, because it does do stuff like that.
And next question, how many people that come out of the cinema do you reckon would think about that?
Very few, because this is the thing. You also have to have a background in already thinking about these things. Like, you either have to be somebody who's...
Well, you don't have to be, but you...
You normally have to be somebody that's already thinking about these issues or knows about these issues in order to pick up on these things. Like, and most of the general public don't.
But don't you think it also boils down to what we want to do when we go to the cinema, what people want to do? They want to just let their cares...
I'm not convinced that that is necessarily a thing, because, you know, if you just want to turn off, then, you know, just watching, you know, so like even reality TV would do that for you. You want something a bit...
If Simon Pegg is allowed to bring up Jean Baudrillard in his Rican that he did in response to all of this...
Being loud.
If he brought up Jean Baudrillard.
Yes.
I'm gonna bring up the one of the more important theories about all of this. Forget Jean Baudrillard and the idea that mass media is infantilizing people. Roland Barthes wrote before him about the death of the author, and he said that the audience creates meaning, not the author. Thus, it is all the experiences of the audience before they interact with a text then leads to the meaning that they derive from it. If you have somebody that goes in to watch Captain America the Winter Soldier and A, they're not keeping track of what's happening in Westminster at the moment and Whitehall, B, know nothing about cyber terrorism, C, know nothing about big data, and D, know nothing about the leaps being made in predictive technology, they will not see the warning of mass surveillance within that film.
Yeah, but it's also part of escapism. You do go to the cinema to see a good story and escape.
Well, and some people down to do.
It's down to what you actually choose to see at that point. And
well, yeah, but that's where the Death of the Author comes in. Because if the audience goes in thinking, I just want to switch off for a bit, that's what they'll do. Of course, then it's up. Then if a filmmaker does want to get a point across, they have to perhaps do things to make the audience feel uncomfortable whilst they're viewing it, which is what you might get in slightly more the serious films that Peg is sort of talking about.
I mean, personally,
12 Years a Slave, which is one of my favourite films of last year, 12 Years a Slave, brilliant film.
Personally, I don't like this idea of, you know, going somewhere like into the cinema to switch off. I go in there to switch over.
Have a new train of thought.
Yeah, that type of thing. So, you know, I don't, you know, want to kind of go into the cinema and just switch off because, you know, when I come out, it's like, yeah, I've just paid, you know, so like £7 or whatever in order to sit in a room and look at, you know...
I don't like watching things uncritically or reading things uncritically. Absolutely. Or playing things uncritically because that means that people could slip in something of their own meaning in it and you might not get the chance to question it. Mm. I like to be an active participant in what I consume. If we weren't, you end up with a situation which you have in 1984 where if you're not somebody like, was it Winston or whatever, the main protagonist, who starts questioning what it is that he consumes in terms of media, you are just a passive body walking through life, which is kind of alarming if you consider the amount of time that people these days spend engaged with entertainment.
Yeah, entertainment has got its, you know, but at the end of the day, you do learn things from entertainment.
Well, you certainly get the chance to observe different things, but I really don't like the idea of switching off. But then, like, the stuff that Peg kind of refers to as kind of better, essentially, than most comic book movies. Those, like The Godfather, Taxi Driver, Bonnie and Clyde and The French Connection all did things to make you feel uncomfortable during the viewing experience. They either showed particular grisly things that I think actually all of those films in their current certification in this country are rated 18 anyway. So they're not suitable for family audiences. So they do things with violence and the body that you can't get away with in a 12A rated film. But then something like that's 15 rated, like Nightcrawler, which obviously came out last year, you could be like, oh yeah, it's Jake Gyllenhaal, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, but if you watch the film, it does so much in terms of its camera work, the positioning of the characters to make you instantly feel uncomfortable and question motives and question why things are happening and slowly being horrified by the film. Gone Girl does the same. Like, you could be like, oh, this is a nice thriller. You do not feel comfortable at all during film. But those are 15 and 18 rated films. The issue here then becomes the family rated films, which is what the Marvel films are kind of chasing after. They're chasing after that PG or 12A certificate so that they can get out to as many people as possible. And it's about money then. And again, comes back to marketing and money and trying to reach the broadest audience possible.
Forget the original Star Wars was a PG as well.
Yep. And then obviously you've got the fact that there, you
so
do
surely
get...
it's a bit unfair to actually compare a family film to The Godfather.
It is a bit. Because they don't have the same opportunity to shock. But at the same time, like, he didn't manage to bring up something like Big Hero 6, which was a Marvel comic book film that came out in the past 12 months. And Big Hero 6 is a PG-rated film that actually asks a lot of questions of its audience when you watch it. You could try and watch it passively, but then if you try to watch that film passively, you will miss some of the biggest emotional impact that film can have, which, well, left me bawling my eyes out during numerous points of the film as I engaged with it. It was, you know, it's a very thoughtful film, and these they do happen. So at the same time, it's kind of like, well, there are moments of big questions and stuff within the films, but okay, switching it back to the audience and recanting some of it is partially the audience's fault if they choose not to engage and switch off. I mean, a film director can only do so much. I mean, you know, it's like they either sort of like really put you in the film, as it were, in a perspective that makes you feel really awkward of that, or they come out onto the screening stage with a, you know, megaphone and start screaming at you and going, you know, feel awkward now, please. Please feel awkward. This is horrible what's happening on screen. This is not entertainment anymore. It's making a point. Anyone? Maybe we should read a bit of Peg's recant. So after the interview with Radio Times kind of got publicised, he wrote a blog post over on his blog, on his website, and I'm going to quote some of it. In the 18 years since we wrote Spaced, because he previously in this blog post talks about how adolescence has been extended. In the 18 years since we wrote Space, this extended adolescence has been cannily co-opted by market forces, finally we get to the marketing, who have identified this relatively new demographic as an incredibly lucrative wellspring of consumerist potential. Suddenly, here was an entire generation crying out for an evolved version of the things they were consuming as children. This demographic is now well and truly serviced in all facets of entertainment, and the first and second childhoods have merged into a mainstream phenomenon. Before Star Wars, the big Hollywood studios were making art movies with morally ambiguous characters that were thematically troubling and often dark. Travis Bickle dark as opposed to Bruce Wayne dark. This was probably due in large part to the Vietnam War and the fact that a large portion of America's young men were being forced to grow up very quickly. Images being back home from the conflict were troubling, and a growing protest movement formed the nation to question the action abroad. Elsewhere, feminism was still dismissed as a lunatic fringe by the patriarchal guard, as mainstream culture actively perpetrated traditional gender roles. Star Wars were very much an antidote to the moral confusion of the war, solving the conundrum of who was good and who was evil. At the heart of the story was an ass-kicking princess who must surely have empowered an entire generation of girls. It was balm for a nation in crisis in a number of ways, and such was that nation's influence the film became a global phenomenon. And this afterwards, you know, manages to bring up Jean Vaudreuil's America and the infantilization of society through market forces. So it's like, well, yes, you've got all these conflicts happening now, but then to say that we live in a time where people, again, don't want to have some kind of cultural balm because of worldwide events is kind of crazy. I mean, there's nasty shit going on in the world today. America, it's interesting to see how its media has changed since 9/11 happened. Mm. And yeah, a lot of the soup, to me, the rise of comic book films is a response to 9/11, of feeling powerless in the face of overwhelming forces, and then being able to take control and do something about it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the superhero films that have been out have been not just, you know, kind of talking about being invaded, but also talking about, like, homegrown terrorism. Like, say, for example, you know, the extremists in Iron Man 3. Mm. So I can see, yeah, that there is a certain level of, you know, kind of pointing towards the social problems that we see. Is it enough, though?
Is it enough? Well, it's kept so, because obviously I'm holding up Captain America the Winter Soldier as, like, the ultimate in this genre, pointing a finger.
Mm.
Probably not enough. I mean, the things that make Captain America great aren't just the fact that it asks questions of actual legal and ethical issues that are currently affecting governments worldwide. Mm. It's the fact that actually it's a tightly written film, which actually makes it entertaining. I can't explain my concept of tight, but basically, for me, Captain America the Winter Soldier is very well scripted, it's very well acted, it's very well shot. It's actually a very well-made film on a technical level. I wouldn't go as far to say it's as brilliant as, say, Argo, you know, an Oscar winner, but it's a very, very well-made film. And then I look at something like Avengers Age of Ultron, and all the tightness that you had in Captain America the Winter Soldier as a film is not present at all in Age of Ultron, which is just this rambling mess to me that has great spectacular things happening, but there's little cohesion in terms of the quality of acting, the script writing, and the direction that happens in the film. And so it's like, well, yeah, you could make a point in a film, but then the film has to be well made in the first place.
Mm.
And unfortunately, the way Marvel is churning out films at the moment, and this, you know, it's got this schedule going up to 2020 of what it wants released, and it's just churning out these films at an impossible rate in some ways, because there's a lack of quality control going in. It's sometimes when it comes to things like the script, like For the Dark World definitely suffered, I think.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Guardians of the Galaxy, while tightly written, didn't really say anything. But then
it was
almost like its own kind of Star Wars, the way it was put together.
Yeah.
Conceptually and thematically. So, you know.
In fact, the parallels between it, come to think of it, you know, because the first Star Wars, obviously you had, you know, kind of Luke encountering the droids, sending the message to Ben, and then kind of almost like recruiting people as he went along. And that's exactly what happened in Guardians of the Galaxy. It's like a load of lone wolves
and a planet-destroying force was in operation as well in both films.
Yes.
Anyone else notice this? Anybody else?
Yeah. Mm. He wasn't family orientated, was he? He didn't have his whole family around him. Hidden in plain view.
I think you could blame the audience, but I'd also blame the studios and the distributors about, because they, at the end of the day, the way the system for film is set up now is they want to make money. I mean, and you could say, oh, but then, you know, it's got to be the art house films that have to go out and make a point. But then they don't get enough money and they don't get marketed very well. And then sometimes, actually, art house films, which he seems to revere in some ways, they go so far up their own arse that you're unable to see the point. Some of them do, not all of them, but some.
I mean, the ones that he listed off, you know, Taxi Driver and whatnot, they...
Yeah, they're pretty fine.
It's a super, you know, kind of... Like, I'm not doing it for the audience, I'm doing it for my own directorial kind of, you know, pleasure. Oh, but I'm sticking it in for, you know, commercial purposes and whatnot to get money off it.
But, I mean, I suppose to go back to the whole, it's what makes money that the studios are going to push. If we look at the period where Jaws, Star Wars, and the end of these sort of, art house, these director-led films, these auteur-led films came out, you had... The film that destroyed a studio in this period, the almighty Heaven's Gate, a film which destroyed one of the biggest film studios in America through running massively over budget and shooting schedule. And once it finally released, it pretty much killed the studio off it. I think it kind of got absorbed into
United Artists,
yeah, and got absorbed into MGM, I think, at the time. And that was an auteur director-led film that had come out eventually, I mean, because it took so long for it to be made, as this whole blockbuster phenomenon was sort of kicking off. And it might have had a point to say. I've never watched it. The closest I've come to watching is watching Sorcerer, which is a genuinely good film. Heaven's Gate, I've never really wanted to watch because of how bad its reputation is.
But, I mean, we've kind of talked about, you know, like all sorts of different aspects related to this. I think one of the things, though, is that, you know, this was obviously kind of from an interview. You know, he said that he was kind of feeling a bit trollish, which is fair enough. And it's not necessarily taken out of context per se, but it's in probably the wrong context. You know, Simon Pegg isn't coming out kicking and screaming saying geeks are infantile and, you know, should die or anything like that. It, you know, he's kind of critiquing his love, as it were. And I do feel that sometimes when it comes to geek culture, we are a bit too protective.
Yeah. But then what annoys me is on the side of geek culture that will hold up the less intelligent things that then get adapted. You know, all stuff that gets adapted is dumbed down. So somebody criticised The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl a few weeks ago. And they kind of didn't like basically how it had gender positive things going on in it, and body positive things going on in it and stuff. And I was like thinking, well, if they were a vocal enough minority, if Unbeatable Squirrel Girl ever gets into a film, she's probably going to end up as some sexed up bullshit, basically.
Possibly. I mean, the other aspect of it is how it's marketed. Because if it's, you know, marketed as like this is a you know, film for girls, then it may actually do better as, you know, more true to the source. If it's a case of, oh yeah, we're gonna just do general release, target at everybody, then yeah, they will try and sex it up.
But at the same, it's also just like the kind of geeks that don't like the intelligent stuff, they are out there, but I'm not sure if they're a majority anymore, but they just happen to be this really vocal minority, which might be a vocal minority that Peg's picking up on, but not realizing they're a minority rather than a majority.
Well,
so
to be honest, it's kind of going around where you kind of realise, oh, that those loud people over there, they make up a minority.
Yeah, you know, it's like the kind of people he's talking about are the people that want the big tit ass out Spider Woman on the front cover of their Spider Woman comic, as we've previously discussed, or, you know, Catwoman in compromising positions while her awkward, depraved, horrific life story kind of takes a sideline because she's having sex with Bruce Wayne on a rooftop. Batman. You know, it's just like the stuff, you know.
It'll be interesting to find out who's the most outraged about, you know, what Peg said.
Yeah.
But it's like the intelligent stuff is out there, but it just doesn't get publicised enough. And then, like, just to bring back another piece of classic sci-fi that has been in development hell again, and we brought it up either last episode or previous episode, Forever War. That is a really intelligent piece of science fiction, and it has been in film development hell since pretty much the first book was published. So it's been in development hell for over 30 years. That's intelligence. Like, if the thing ever gets out, you know, will it resemble any of the intelligence that's in it? It won't be the audience that decides on what the intelligent messages are that get carried over from the book into the film. It's going to be, obviously, the scriptwriters that are involved in adapting it. And then the studio, who again have to have final say for what happens. I mean, I haven't watched Ender's Game, for instance, going to something that was in development hell for years and finally got out. And the original novel, despite disliking Orson Scott Card, is an intelligent novel. It's very, very well thought out, raises some very interesting points around morality and war, things like this. And according to people who have read the book and watched the film fails to handle these questions. So the original source material had this level of intelligence. It goes through the studio system and comes out as kind of like bland vanilla ice cream when before it was actually Neapolitan.
I mean, there's just one thing that I've just thought of, which is basically, you know, Simon Pegg used, you know, kind of comic books as kind of as a way to say, you know, it's been infantilized in our tastes as a whole. And I think part of the problem is that it's the general public, or, you know, not necessarily general public, but it's been widely perceived that comic books are for kids. And these same people are going to see the movie versions of the comic book characters. And I think maybe slightly drawing on the hypocrisy of that.
Well, the audience is the author. You know, they're drawing these expectations into the film and thus not giving it a chance. The same could be said as the people actually making the film, again, making the studio decisions. A lot of the kinds of people that are in heady positions in media, including film, come from incredibly middle-class backgrounds that have traditionally, due to their age and where we are, and looked down on geek culture and have never looked at the more intelligent side of what gets produced within science fiction and fantasy and
which,
comic books,
as a
and
whole,
video games.
Is usually quite a lot, because geeks are generally intelligent.
Well,
I mean, you will have, you know, the kind of geeks that go out there buy comic books because you know, they like big explosions
and tits.
But then I feel like a lot of geeks go out there and want something more. They want something to think about. No, they want to be challenged on an intellectual level.
Oh, yeah, but then you kind of, I saunter onto, like, I don't know, like a supernatural subreddit or something.
Oh, that's never good.
And see some of, like, somebody's complaining about certain aspects of season 10, and in an intelligent way, and calling it out on bad writing and stuff. And then you'll get the comments of, from apparent supernatural geeks, why can't you just watch it for what it is?
Yeah.
And that still happens within geekdom. If you try to kind of question why Catwoman is posed the way she is, and possibly so, you'll be like, it's just a comic. And, you know, this is an issue within
but, I mean, a geek audience as well. Is that a genuine, you shouldn't care about this, or is that an actual, I don't think you should be attacking my love, therefore I'm going to try and do everything in order to, nullify
you. The first one, it's just like you shouldn't be dissing it because it's just a piece of entertainment. Mm.
But I mean, in the end, I mean, would you say that Simon Pegg was wrong in what he said?
I would say that his contextualization was wrong. And I think he missed out too much of a big part of the picture. And he used big words when he didn't have to explain. Like, he sort of drew on Baudrillard rather than sort of and market and using terms like market forces rather than talking about how basically his paymasters work. At the end of the day,
his paymasters,
because he used this language. It felt like to also guard himself. Because he's already involved in this industry, and nobody's position is necessarily safe in films. It's been proven time and time again that if you say the wrong thing in the wrong place at the wrong time, suddenly you don't get work for ages.
Yeah.
So he didn't talk about the middleman that helps dumb shit down. And it isn't for the sake of keeping people compliant and happy. Mm. They just their thought is it's not going to sell.
Because I've not actually seen the actual interview itself. I've literally just kind of read it. Like, say, for example, from the Radio Times, I've just read like the snippets that have been kind of plastered over the internet. So I'm not sure what he said other than,
He had to recant the reason.
Oh, yeah.
The snippets got the main, because he talked about other things in the interview.
Yeah. And that's the thing, he might have, kind of said about stuff in the rest of the interview that just wasn't printed.
He might have done, but he's had to do a big recant.
Yeah.
On his website. It's a very long post. I suppose we should probably, at this point, move on to what we've been up to. I don't think we have enough time to talk about any more news. I mean, that was the biggest news.
It was.
Last week,
apart
anyway.
From Richard and Richard 3 in Korea.
What?
Didn't you hear about Richard 3 in Korea?
No. Quickly.
Okay, so Richard 2 did really well in Korea. To thank the loyal fan base, they announced that the PC version of Richard 3 would be available on day of release with the Korean language. So loads of Koreans sat up, downloaded it from Steam for $60, downloaded it to find there was no Korean language.
Promises broken.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. And then the devs had to make an admission that for some reason, when they were compiling the PC version of the game, somebody forgot to put the language pack in there.
You had one job!
So they then turned around and said, really apologise, we'll get the language pack out, along with the Japanese language pack out, on the 21st of May.
Did it?
Yes. I haven't seen anything to say otherwise, but obviously it just meant that people had to wait a bit longer to play their new game, and then I think that I found a bit ironic was the fact that one of their biggest gaming store chains was selling the actual physical copy of the PC game.
And it had no Korean on it.
For $20 less than the Steam version.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's all right if you had a console, because it did. Yeah. The console versions had the Korean language.
Oh, okay.
So the work had been done, it's just not been updated.
It was just the PC version.
Yeah. Okay. All right, what people have been up to. Okay, I'm gonna go first because the Dave Internet allowed me to watch a certain season finale last week live.
You watched The Flash?
No, I watched the Supernatural season 10 finale, Brother's Keeper, and it was an interesting episode which retconned some of the lore, added new lore, crazy shit happened, there was much feels professed upon screen, much feels, there were tears, there was much blood. There was blood coming out of eyes at one point, and the big bad for season 11 was set up by the end of the episode as well.
I was gonna say up until that point, I was gonna say just like my Saturday night, bleeding from the eyes, and
it's again like previous episodes. Split opinion, though it's still been viewed more positively than not the previous episode, but the episode before that. So that's a good thing. And it's guaranteed to come back anyway for next season, though like the rating figures were kind of out of place. I enjoyed the episode. I still felt there were some issues and they left a lot of stuff open.
Can I just ask, do you know about what kind of viewing figures the first couple of seasons had?
First season was like crap because it's the first season, but yeah. It scraped through enough to get a second season. Season three was a bit all over the place because of the writer's strike.
Because it does make me wonder, because you get like seasons, like say for example Heroes, that started, the first season started off with a humongous viewer base, and then
first season of Heroes was epic.
Yeah, and then it kind of reduced down, and it, even though it was a reasonable level, they cancelled it because they set up the expectations for it to be so much higher the beginning. And I mean,
part of the issue with Supernatural was that it has it always pulls, it seems like, over a million point two viewers per episode. Mm. There's some episodes that will do way more than that. But there's weird issues within the fan community, like to do with particular relationships between characters that previously were perhaps pandered to, and now those perceptions between the relationships of those characters are no longer pandered to as much for the sake of the fan community, and that's led to people apparently dropping out. But then what really weirdly happened with Supernatural this season in the States is that it got moved from a Tuesday slot to a Wednesday slot after one of the hiatuses, like one of the mid-season hiatuses. It was either after Christmas or after sweeps, and it got moved to Wednesday, and that may also have impact, because it had a Tuesday slot for years, and this may have, in fact, also impacted viewing figures as well.
I still think that's one of the reasons Constantine didn't do so well.
Was it because it got moved around?
No, it got put on later on Friday night, didn't it?
Yeah, that's probably not going to help.
Which is really weird.
But yeah, so I, without spoiling it, because obviously, you know, it's not been on in the UK yet, and it's not going to be on in the UK yet for a bloody long time. The finale of season 10 of Supernatural was, I enjoyed it. There are people that didn't enjoy it, and have now sworn that they're not going to watch season 11. There was enough good in season 10 for me to be like, yeah, I'll keep watching. Meanwhile, I picked up The Castle Bug again. The Castle Bug. And finished watching season 2 and started watching season 3. Season 3 I haven't seen before. Because I saw like the last 5 episodes of season 2 before starting season 3, like over the weekend. And it was interesting. There was a shift in writing.
Mm-hmm.
Like between seasons 2 and 3. Like in 3, things feel a bit more dumbed down at the moment.
Really?
Yeah, stuff doesn't seem as intelligent as it did in the previous season. It feels like there's different writers in charge. I might be speaking out of my ass, but that does, to me, feel like a tonal difference.
To be fair, though, I mean, sometimes you can tell that with series.
Mm.
Like Andromeda, they dropped the ball season 3, like halfway through, and it's like you could tell the quality of writing went hit the floor. Same with Sliders.
I don't know what possessed me on Saturday night. I think it was, yes, I don't know. I decided to watch Rob Zombie's remake of House of a Thousand Corpses. I don't know why I decided to suddenly watch it. I wanted to watch a...
How much cider had you drunk?
None, because I had to drive the following day. I was just kind of like, oh, maybe I'll see how bad or good it is. And it turned out to be a middling film that was slightly better than Catwoman, so thus it wasn't a truly bad film. So,
But in comparison to other horror films?
In comparison to horror films, it was crap. like... I'm watching it, and there's like these weird kind of negative style effect cutaways that, because Rob Zombie wrote and directed it and had a minor starring role, and he did the music as well. And there's these weird cutaway scenes where they'll make the picture like go into this weird kind of negative color effect, sort of inverse the colors or whatever. And it was like watching bits of his music videos, and it just did not translate well at all to the film. In fact, there were these weird cutaway moments where they inserted strange bits of characterization or exposition that were like, if you just cut all of those moments out of the film, it would work better as a film and still make just as much sense. It was like...
I think part of the problem, though, is that it started with footage that was kind of not necessarily a part of the film per se, but it was kind of designed to set up the mood.
Yeah.
And then halfway through, he switched to cutaway shots, which did actually relate to the film.
Yeah.
Like with the characters.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was like one character in the film that was like a owner of like a weird sort of, not a sideshow, but like a place that kind of lorded over sideshows and the lesser known mass murderers of North America's rural areas, and his doctor, something of that, and he, like, you kind of like, is he or isn't he a bad guy for much of the film? And then when he turns out to be one rather than the other, I was just kind of like, it would have been far more interesting if he turned out to be the opposite and had, because there was like almost no redemption for anyone in that film, which was kind of bad for a horror that nobody kind of got redeemed. And the and Netflix's description, I haven't bothered to go beyond Netflix's description, kind of said that basically, or sort of like the Devil's Rejects description, said it was essentially kind of like a sort of sequel to A House of a Thousand Corpses. I was expecting a sort of like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, the original, situation to develop about halfway through the film, but was bitterly disappointed that such a situation did not actually develop.
That's the thing, I mean, with horror films, you know, you obviously got what's known as the last girl.
Yeah.
A lot of the time.
Or the final girl.
Or the final girl, rather. And that's usually a character that decides to stand up for themselves and, you know, at least tries to actually learn kind of a skill set to do that. And I don't feel like there was quite that.
It didn't really happen, no. It was quite bad. And that's why I was like, I was expecting Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 to happen. It didn't happen. And Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 does have a final girl that properly fights back. You know, it's like she's like, you know, it's like Thingy from Halloween.
Mm.
That, you know, is it Thingy Foster that plays her?
I don't
know. You know, she fights back and stuff. And then last night was spent watching cool stuff. I finally got around to watching Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
Cool.
Norrell or Norrell?
Norrell.
Norrell.
Which is a BBC series that's adapted, I believe, from a novel of the same name or similar name about magic during the war between us and France in the late 1700s.
France.
Cool.
I'm just taking a piss tonight.
Yeah, you are. It's actually really good. I don't know if episode one's still on iPlayer, because episode two was on... last night, but I watched both of them recorded, and it's actually really good. I think people who are outside of the UK should keep an eye out for it, especially if it ends up on stuff like BBC America, because it's well interesting and has a...
It's well good.
It's well good and has an intriguing take on magic and fae, as they are called.
Fae.
F-A-E. Cookie, what have you been up to?
Not a lot. I have been I have been playing Titanfall. Killing lots of people on that. destroying those large robots, getting quite addicted to the variety map, variety playlist, where it just randomly selects maps and different game modes to play, which is pretty cool. And so I've been sucked into that quite a bit. I've also been playing a bit more Evolve, which I'm getting more into. And I finished off Call of Duty Ghosts on the actual campaign.
Is that the first Call of Duty Ghosts?
There's only one Call of Duty Ghosts.
I might be thinking of something else then.
Yeah, thinking of Black Ops.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, Black Ops 1, 2, and 3 is how this unit. Call of Duty campaigns I've normally played through, and they've been enjoyable. Really good set pieces, which there has been in this one. The underwater levels, where you're actually scuba diving and shooting people, pretty cool. The space combat was pretty cool as well. Actually, in your spacesuit, jumping from the different parts of the space station, with your jetpack, and taking into account that you've suddenly got a whole 360 degree angle where people can just shoot at you from. That was pretty cool. And the ending threw me, because they've got all Marvel. It had a post credit scene.
Oh.
Yeah. And not only that, it actually ended it on a cliffhanger.
So they could set up another sequel, easily.
And it was quite an interesting cliffhanger as well. To which I just went, oh, you buggers. How dare you? So that's been pretty cool. And then I've also been watching a series on Netflix, which I believe Paul's been watching as well.
Well, technically I watched it a bit as well, but Paul hasn't been watching much else. You've been busy doing animation stuff, but shall we talk about Grace and Frankie for a minute then between us? So is it genuinely a Netflix original series? It's not one they're calling an original series that they've just bought in. It is one that they've actually made.
I believe so, yeah, because it was only launched this year.
Yeah, and they released all the episodes a while ago. But
the story follows two families, in essence, kind of go through almost like a whirlwind when the two fathers, or the two patriarchs, decide, who are also business partners, decide that they actually love each other and to leave their wives.
Well, it turns out the relationship appears to have been going on for 20 years out of the 40 years worth of marriage.
Yep. Yes. They leave their wives and they get together.
And it throws the whole family into turmoil.
Yes.
Yes.
And it's an interesting look at the situation, because obviously if it was just, two families and it was like a husband and a wife that kind of did that,
it wouldn't bring up these weird questions about sexuality that you're left asking yourself. And it kind of also looks at, because like one of the first things put out in the first episode is like, oh yeah, we can marry now. They decided to do it then because they can finally get married as a gay couple.
Yes.
And so it kind of, for the kind of idea, because these gentlemen are in their, I think, 70s at this point. You know, they're not, or late 60s, not young.
I mean, we were talking earlier on about, kind of stories based around, the real world, how things are going. Brooklyn Nine-Nine had one episode a couple of weeks ago. That kind of saw like the captain get married to his husband, although that was a flashback anyway. Yeah.
But
they did it in Flash as well.
What, two gay characters got married in Flash?
They haven't got married yet, but they did. The captain of the Metro Police is seeing a guy, and they actually proposed to each other during this season, which is pretty cool, actually.
I think that makes Emily want to watch The Flash a bit more now.
It does, actually. more so than Arrow. I'm sorry. Due to Dave Internet, I've seen some of the tail ends of the current Arrow.
Have you?
Whilst waiting for Supernatural.
Have you?
All right.
Yeah.
And you never let Paul watch it.
Paul didn't want to be up at stupid o'clock.
Well, for the first time.
For the first time.
For the second time, I was like, it's the last one. I'll just, stay
up. Well, in case I cry my eyes out.
Yeah. Just, If it was going to be that bad, I didn't want to come down the next morning and see you, like, hanging there.
Going back to Grace and Frankie, I think Netflix has been a bit misingenuous, not so great in describing the series. They, like, kind of called it a comedy, and to me it's more of a black comedy.
Yes,
it
definitely.
Is, it's very dry humour.
It's like,
but the cast is well put together as well, though.
Mm. But yeah, because there's a Sheen.
Yes, Martin Sheen.
Yes, Martin Sheen playing a gay guy, which is got to be seen to be believed.
And Thingy Fonda, is it Fonda?
Oh, Jane Fonda.
Jane Fonda. Yeah. Barbara Ellen.
I don't recognise any of the other actors or actresses, but I mean, that's not necessarily
a bad thing.
The other
guy's been in quite a bit as well.
Sorry?
The other guy's been in quite a bit, including Serial Mum with Kathleen Turner.
Okay.
And the lady in it, she's been in loads as well. She's been in lots of comedies.
But I think what's really interesting about the series is that apart from questioning what it means to be in love and what your duty in marriage is as well, because obviously like there's this whole point with the wives that were in these relationships prior to the sort of coming out, in that, well, they expected to be with these men until one of them died.
Yeah, because this all happens obviously in later life, you know, being married for 40 years.
Yeah.
I think it's also to do with the fact that, I know I'll say that a lot, but the two mothers, they hate each other. And that they're kind of forced
with
to kind of. Yeah, they kind of. They're forced.
Together.
Yeah, together. And kind of create a, you know, uneasy bond.
Yeah.
That. Yeah, it's quite interesting kind of seeing them kind of react to each other because they're completely different types of people.
But what's also interesting, like, is how the series is exploring what do you do in your later years in life, because both of the women are retired, or they're sort of self-wow. In the case of the artistic one, which is not Jane Fonda's character, she's like, she does painting and stuff and sells a bit of painting and teaches like painting to like inmates at a prison or something. But there's like this horrific moment in like the second or third episode where she goes to a retirement home looking for a job and gets offered a place to live there rather than the job. And it's heartbreaking seeing that moment.
Yeah.
But it's just the amount the show's playing around with perceptions of people's life in their in their later years.
Yeah.
And what's expected of them by themselves and society.
And yeah, it's kind of interesting because the gay dads, obviously, you know, there's kind of a bit thing about that. But their new bond, you know, with each other being out in the open, they're far happier, and not necessarily because they're happier, but because they've kind of left their wives to do it. They're also, you know, the bad guys. They're the source of contention.
Yes. And then you've got all these kids between the two families who are like, okay, so art,
who've
so art,
got
so
history as well.
You've got history as well, and they're like, so our dad. There's like a weird dad stepdad situation slowly in development because there's the marriage approaching,
and it's very refreshing actually to see kind of a family dynamic that is this far outside of the norm in essence,
and seeing it explored.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And the other lady is played by the comedian Lily Tomlin,
and
who has been in loads of stuff: 9 to 5, Big Business, Orange County, Damages, Pink Panther 2.
And on and on.
Yeah, pretty much, to be fair.
And what else have you been up to for?
Me? I have been kind of making an animation. And the animation's
which
part
is why
of...
it's not been watching anything.
No.
Or playing anything.
Yeah. Not that it's taken me quite that long, but, you know, I've been doing other stuff as well, just not necessarily, you know, things that, you know, that interesting. But, I've made an animation that's kind of designed to be, like, at the beginning of a recut of a film that I made a few years ago. So I'm recutting it so that, you know...
It's tighter and has better effects.
Yes. And just more believable and, you know, obviously better production values, even if, you know, I can only do so much with post-production. But, I've been making an animation for that, and
that's cool.
Turned out actually quite good.
Mm.
I think.
Nice one.
Okay. Well, I think, chaps, that is all we've got time for this week, I'm afraid. I hope you, dear listeners, found our Simon Pegg in discussion interesting. In relating to serious sci-fi, we've actually got next week for episode 138, because obviously we did that Star Wars episode and we're trying to make it a monthly thing where we look at, everyone looks at something and then we talk about it for an episode. Next week we will be discussing Blade Runner. And so if you wish to refresh your memory or you've never seen Blade Runner before, we're between us going to be either watching the director's cut or the final cut, depending what people have available. The final cut, I researched the differences between the director's cut and the final cut. The director's cut, Ridley was, he had some say in how it was cut, but he was not directly involved. The final cut, he had full creative control over how the film was cut together. That's the difference between the two. I'm preferring the final cut at the moment because obviously it's Scott's original vision in a sense. If you don't fancy watching the film but wish to participate in some way, I will probably be drawing up memories from my original reading of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which is the Philip K. Dick novel that Blade Runner was based on.
And no doubt Retroid will be quoting Blade Runner all the way through.
Yeah. So please watch Blade Runner, either the director's cut or the final cut, before you this come back to listen to us for episode 138, which is next week's episode.
It's either that or listen to the podcast, then watch the film, then listen to the podcast again.
Yes.
Yeah.
You could listen to us many times. You can listen to us as many times as you want, as long as you listen to us.
That's not too bad.
But as ever, you can find notes for this episode over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. Do tweet us. We like to read tweets. You can also find us on Facebook and Google+, as Nerds Assemble Podcast. Don't forget to check out hexdimension.com for little bits and pieces. And good night.
Good night.
Good night.